Good day, and welcome to the eighth presentation of Inside the Beltway by Drinker Biddle. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, and hello, everybody. Welcome to the program. There are several speakers today. I'm one, Fred Riche. I'm in the Los Angeles office of Drinker Biddle. Also with me is Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. As many of you all know, Brad is a former assistant secretary at the Department of Labor who oversaw the Employee Benefits Security Administration and has tremendous insights on how they operate. Also with us is Ted Becker, who is an ERISA litigator from our Chicago office, and we'll get to Ted a little bit later, but it's about a recent development. And Jim Dolan from NatTixis is with me, and I want to thank Jim and NatTixis for supporting this. They enable us to bring this to you, so you should show them your appreciation. I want you all to know that this is being recorded. The couple of reasons you should know that. One, we're going to have a Q&A period at the end, and your question will be recorded, as well as our answer. Secondly, if you want to revisit something we said, or if you want some of the other folks in your firm to listen to it, in a couple of days, we'll send out an email to everybody that's registered for the conference saying this has been posted on our website, and you'll be able to link to the recording. And it'll be on the website of www.drinkerbiddle.com. There's a tab there called Resources, and it'll be under the Resources tab. But it won't be up for a couple of days, so you'll get the email when it's posted. Once again, you know, Jim, I want to thank you and NatTixis for your support. It'd be pretty hard to do these without those. What, you want to say a couple things to folks?
That would be great, Fred. I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity, and we're grateful for the partnership. I do want to thank you, Brad, and Ted for joining the call, and wanted to thank all the participants who took the time out of their day to call in. We appreciate it. We're glad we're able to do this quarterly, and we look forward to continue doing it. Just by way of introduction, my name's Jim Dolan with the Retirement Strategies Group of NatTixis Global Asset Management. Our mission is to help people lead better financial lives. We simply do this through a process called durable portfolio construction, and we provide access to more than 20 specialized investment managers. Some of our callers might be familiar with our affiliates, Loomis Sayles, Harris Associates, and the Oakmark Funds. Today, as I did on our last call, I'd just like to highlight our recent recognition from Barron's for being the top mutual fund family of 2013. I'm going to make sure I say that as much as I can during this year. And also, I'd ask you just to take a moment and look at our website, durableportfolios.com, to learn more about our focus on retirement. So, Fred, again, appreciate the opportunity, and I look forward to the call.
Well, Jim, thank you very much, and congratulations on those 2013 awards. That's pretty good. I'm going to lead off the session. You all got an agenda that we mailed out a few weeks ago. But since we drafted the agenda, there's been a couple of significant developments. And one of the reasons that we do these as conference calls rather than webcasts is that we want to be able to talk about the most current thing. And we will get through the agenda. So we're going to talk about everything we promised that we would talk about. But we're also going to put in some new developments. And we're going to lead off, in fact, with one of the new developments. And Brad and I will be talking about that. Just a few weeks ago, the Department of Labor issued, as did the administration generally, its semi-annual regulatory agenda where they update the list of regulations they're working on and what the status of each one is. The first one that caught our eyes was the so-called conflict of interest rule, which many of you all will think of as the fiduciary investment advice rule. That's the one where the DOL is proposing to redefine fiduciary in a way that would expand it so that more consultants and advisors would be classified as fiduciaries under the law. When they did the last version of the regulatory agenda, that was last fall, they said they thought that proposed regulation would be coming out in August. The new version, the spring regulatory agenda, says that that's been delayed until January of 2015. So, in other words, they're saying it's been delayed by about 4 months. With that in mind, let me pose a question to Brad. Brad, what do you make of this? What do you think is the reason behind it? Is there anything Machiavellian that we should be thinking or worrying about here? fill us in, Brad.
Well, I think, Fred, this is where you and I do need to take a moment and claim credit for having correctly predicted this. We've been saying for a while that it seems unlikely to us they would actually issue this proposed regulation in August, particularly since that would only be a couple months in advance of what's going to be a highly contested midterm congressional election. And it just seems a bad time to put out a very controversial regulation. So I personally think that that's the primary motivation. One can certainly argue that there's always some creep in the regulatory schedule. But to me, the timing seems more to suggest that it isn't the time to pick this political fight right before an election, especially given that the delay is relatively small, only 4 months. That seems to correspond roughly with the amount of time that it would take to send the regulation to the White House and have their OMB and have them take about 90 days to review it before it's published. And all of that would then occur right after the election. So that's what I think is happening there. We can call that Machiavellian or just political reality, but I think that's really what's going on.
That's pretty standard operating procedure politically, isn't it, that the White House doesn't want the administrative agencies creating controversy a few months before elections. Is that right?
That's typical, yeah. And sometimes that works for them and sometimes it doesn't. But I personally think that's probably the primary reason. In terms of actual substantive changes to the regulation itself, we still don't have any new information on that other than, you know, as we've said in other calls, I still think one of the crucial issues to watch that'll be somewhat new, other than the things that we've been talking about now for 4 years, is what the department decides to do on IRA rollover solicitations and what new elements in this reproposed regulation might address that to get the department stronger tools to wrap their hands around those discussions. And that seems to echo where we're seeing across the government, we're seeing a lot of consternation. Maybe that's not the right word. Maybe I think there's an increasing awareness that IRA assets are about to outstrip ERISA assets over the next couple of years, and that IRAs are not an ancillary program, but one of the primary savings vehicles at this point. And I think across the government we're seeing a lot of concern about how well that system is being regulated and what issues it might present. So DOL is going to be a major player in terms of what it will propose to address those rollover issues.
Yeah, I agree. Matter of fact, I'd say the top two issues in this regulation are IRAs and IRAs. And, I mean, a little bit odd because although the DOL has regulatory authority here, they don't have any enforcement authority. And yet the one area where they have limited or no enforcement authority could be the hot button. By IRAs and IRAs, I mean, I think there will be something in the regulation about how plan advisors, regardless of whether they're fiduciaries or not, how far they can go in recommending that a participant take a distribution out of a plan and roll over to an IRA before becoming a fiduciary to that plan, even if they weren't previously. If you look at the FINRA guidance that came out, I think it was in December of last year, they suggest that the recommendation to take a distribution is a securities recommendation and therefore is subject to the suitability standard. Remember, that's FINRA's perspective on thing. If the DOL adopts that, and there does seem to be some increasing coordination between the SEC, FINRA, and the DOL, if the DOL takes the same position, then any recommendation or many recommendations to take a distribution out of a plan and roll over to an IRA, even if the advisor is not an advisor to the plan, would cause that advisor to become a fiduciary and they'd have to make the recommendation in the best interest of the participant after considering all the different variables that could impact that all the material variables that could impact that participant. For example, how low the fees are in the plan. So that's one of the IRAs. The other IRA is that people forget that this definition of fiduciary is also used under the Internal Revenue Code for determining if prohibited transactions have occurred. And a recommendation of an affiliated product or a recommendation that will cause you to make more compensation is also, if it's a fiduciary recommendation, both of those are prohibited transactions subject to certain exemptions. So I think when this ultimately does come out, Brad, the first thing I'm going to look at is the proposed class exemption that's going to come out with it for IRAs. And then the second, maybe I have two first things. First thing is the exemption. for advice to IRAs. The second thing is what the fiduciary rule says about recommendations on distributions. I think that will define the intensity of the fight over this proposal. If those get well managed, where they're tolerable for the private sector, then I think the rule may go through. If not, I just think there's going to be a huge political fight. Is that pretty consistent with how you see it?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think if DOL wants to address IRA rollovers in sort of the most responsible and helpful way to participants as well as service providers, they would put out a class exemption that says, here's how you do an IRA rollover. And this is what the conditions are, and then we can debate those conditions and go through the process on that. But the worst situation would be to leave us in the gray area we have now, where fiduciaries to plans may or may not have a privated transaction when they deal with IRA rollovers from that plan. So if we have just expanded that gray area, then we've caused more problems. And I agree with you, it's going to be an even bigger political fight. Just to be clear for the audience, the DOL has said it intends to retain the interpretation for of the two IRA to IRA issues. DOL has said it's been very clear that it wants to keep the interpretation that it would extend this expanded definition of fiduciary and apply it to IRAs that are currently existing, the effect being that an IRA provider who gives advice to the IRA holder would need to be paid as if they're a fiduciary to avoid a prohibited transaction. DOL has said clearly they want to retain that from the original proposal. The second question, what will they do on IRA solicitations? Will they make that a fiduciary Act as well? That's the part where we're speculating because we've not yet seen it, but we know DOL is interested in this issue because they asked about whether their current position was sufficiently protective back in the 2010 proposal. We believe they'll conclude that it's not and do some additional IRA rollover restrictions.
Agreed. And Brad, I think it's fair that we could both say that we think there's a pretty good chance we will, in fact, get a proposed regulation in the first quarter of next year.
I think it's quite likely, yeah. I think they want to move forward. I think the White House will be certainly with them enough to give them a shot to make the case. After that, I think you're correct in saying this might even be more a political fight than it is policy, depending on what DOL puts out. And I don't know that the fact that the White House lets it go forward to a proposal stage means that necessarily everyone else in the administration will have bought into exactly what DOL wants to do. But that remains to be seen.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the next one. It's the DOL calls it the pension benefit statements regulation, but you and I and most of the world think of it as the regulation that might require the projection of retirement income on participant statements. That was originally scheduled to come out also in August of this year. It also got moved to January of next year. Let me pick up on my earlier Machiavellian theme and Brad, throw it into your court. Is there something Machiavellian going on, as some people would like to think, about any governmental activity, or do you think there's some other reason for this?
I actually think that on this regulation, DOL is, I don't want to imply that they're not operating in good faith on others, but I think there's a good faith. In other words, DOL, I think, has a very open mind on how best to do this. I think they're convinced that it is beneficial to participants to have the statement give them a number in terms of monthly income rather than just mere accumulation, because accumulation doesn't mean much to most folks. I mean, I look at my own 401k statements, and I really have no idea how much that's going to mean for me in retirement. But if it says, $800 a month or $1,200 a month, I know what that means. So I think DOL is committed to that concept, but I think DOL is actually approaching this with a very open mind on the execution of the proposed regulation. How do we go about making those projections? What are the key factors to consider? And I think that's evidenced by the fact that DOL adopted a three-step strategy here instead of their usual two-step. Last year they put out the pre-rule, which talked about all these issues and solicited comments. The next step will be a proposal where DOL will presumably have made the difficult choices to actually think to come to what it thinks is the right answer, and then put that out for comment again. So I think that the play here probably is more substantive than political. It's taking time to sort through some very difficult technical issues.
Yeah, I agree. Actually, you could even call it a four-step process if you want to go back to the RFI that they issued a few years ago.
That's true. Yeah.
So they're really working this one hard, and I think they want to get it right, and I think they want to get a lot of buy-in from the private sector so that you know, there seems to be, if not agreement on every last detail, at least a large consensus that, by and large, it's pretty good. So I think they've delayed this because they're working on it hard, and they want to get it right in the sense that the people generally agree it's being done the right way, or at least among the different good alternatives, it's one of them. Okay, well, let's move on to the target date disclosure. A couple of weeks ago, they said that they were going to reopen the record. Actually, last fall said they were going to issue a final rule in March of this year, but March came and went, and we didn't get a final regulation on the 404A5 disclosures to participants about target date funds and on the QDI regulation about target date funds. Both of those regulations are supposed to be amended to have specific target date fund provisions. There was a notice of proposed rulemaking back in November, a proposed regulation, in other words, November of 2010. It was supposed to go final in March of this year. Then they issued the semi-annual regulatory agenda a couple of weeks ago, and it said they're going to reopen the record on the proposed regulation and take more testimony. They said they'd do it in May. They might have been a day late. That may have come out on June 2nd. But anyway, it's out now. What do you think, Brad?
This is one where I think DOL, for its part, has been prepared to move to a final regulation for some time. Because the issues DOL is looking to require disclosure on, I think, are in some ways more discreet and readily identifiable than sort of some of the broader issues that the SEC is considering in its related regulations. But I think this is a case where the DOL and the SEC are actually coordinating, and the DOL is reopening the record because the SEC has taken its process and slowed it down and reopened it. And so, you know, I think DOL really here is just trying to not get out in front of the SEC with the disclosures that might be required until the SEC has figured out what it wants to do.
Now, I'll tell you, just to the audience, that I'm looking at what the SEC has written and I'm looking at what the DOL has written so far. I think it could change how when these things are finalized. And I agree with Brad's analysis, by the way. I think the SEC, the DOL wants to defer to a degree to the SEC since they're the investment experts. But both of them appear to be taking an approach where a target date fund is an asset allocation vehicle. And I think that the prevailing view, maybe not the correct view, but the common view, is that a target date fund is an investment. And what both the DOL and the SEC are focusing on saying, you know, what are your allocations now? What are they at the target date? When do they stop getting more conservative? You know, what's the end date for the changes in the asset allocation or the glide path? And I actually think that when these rules come out in final form, the plan fiduciaries will be well served, which means their advisors will be well served, to treat target date funds as asset allocation vehicles, meaning that the plan committee has to understand the asset classes. They have to understand the mix of the asset classes, the percentages, how those percentages change, what the effect of them are as compared to other asset allocations and other target date funds, both with regard to asset classes and percentages. So I think we're right at the beginning of a transition period where, you know, I think folks who really study this stuff know that they're asset allocation vehicles, but I don't think that's the common or popular view. I think that going forward, they will be much more closely examined in that regard. Okay, moving on from that. You know, there's a proposal to issue a request for information in the spring agenda, the semiannual agenda that just came out, for the DOL to issue a request for information in May, which has come and gone by a few days, about what the fiduciary standards should be for brokerage windows inside participant-directed plans. Brad, do you want to give us a little bit of the history of that and some of your thinking about it?
Yeah, most of you probably recall back in 2012 when the participant disclosure regulation, the 404A5 regulation, was about to go into final form. DOL put out Field Assistance Bulletin 2012-2 or 02, where they started describing how, you know, some of the compliance issues associated with that final regulation. And one of those was a question that dealt with brokerage windows and seemed to go a lot farther than DOL had ever gone before. It suggested that DOL would adopt an enforcement policy that a plan had complied with the requirements for brokerage windows if, among other things, it treated if enough participants bought the same investments on the other side of the brokerage window, that the plan would then treat them as if they were designated investment alternatives that the plan itself had selected and provide disclosures about those. And that caused quite a lot of controversy that had never been suggested in the regulation to that point. It felt to a lot of us like they were trying to regulate through a guidance document. It got very controversial, and so DOL backed off quickly and issued a revised Field Assistance Bulletin 2012-02R, which basically went back to what the regulation said, that you disclose how the plan window works, the fees associated with it, but you know, there's no big issue for the plan to consider in terms of disclosure of what participants are buying on the other side of the window, what they're investing in on the other side of the window. But in that revised guidance, DOL said, but you know, we're still interested in this issue. We're worried about people using brokerage windows to avoid disclosure. We're worried about certain types of plan designs that might be predominantly or exclusively a collection of brokerage windows. We're going to be back on this issue. And then we didn't hear anything for a couple of years until right before Christmas, when they put out the last semi-annual regulatory agenda. They suggested that they were going to do this RFI on brokerage windows and start looking at all these questions to decide whether and to what extent, I think the quote was, additional guidance or regulation was necessary. So I think a lot of us are assuming it's going to be more broad than just disclosure, that they're really going to look at other fiduciary issues, like how did you select the provider? How did you decide what universe of options is available on the other side of that brokerage window? Was it a limited number of mutual funds? Was it hog futures? You know, what's going on the other side, and how did you decide that? And that this RFI will give us a lot of insight into what issues the department's really worried about by virtue of which questions they ask.
Yeah, I see it the same way, and frankly, I think that they're going to come out someday down the line and say at the very least there is a fiduciary duty to prudently select and monitor the brokerage windows, the provider of the brokerage windows. Is it a competent provider? Do they have proper licensing? Are their fees reasonable? Are they providing adequate services to participants? Because the provider of a brokerage window in that sense, and from a legal perspective, is a service provider to the plan, much like a record keeper, a third-party administrator, or an investment advisor. And those service providers to plans, I think the law is fairly clear, have to be prudently selected and monitored. What I worry about, though, is that maybe in the private sector, and I haven't worked with plan sponsors on this issue, so I don't really know what their thinking is, but I worry that plan sponsors may think that a brokerage window is just something the participant selects so that they don't have any responsibility for it. I think maybe that's gotten woven into the fabric of the 401k community, but I also think that it's probably inconsistent with the law, that there is at least some responsibility. We just don't know how much. And whether it would be a shock to me if after a proper RFI is done, and the DOL gets feedback from the private sector, if they say there's a lot of responsibility, you know, to look down inside the brokerage account other than fees and services and some very, very big picture things. But that's just a guess. That's just my guess. I know, Brad, do you share those same concerns?
Generally, yes. I mean, I think if you're looking at it from DOL's perspective, I think you could divide this into two basic areas. One is sort of the unusual plan designs where there's a bunch of brokerage windows and not much else, or maybe not any other investments, and whether that's a breach of fiduciary duty to disclose investment information to participants. Because essentially what you're disclosing under current 404A5 is a service. You're disclosing how the service of this brokerage window works rather than anything related to investments made through it. So I think that's one area of concern. The other, I think, is them just understanding how they really are working. You know, they're not uncommon plan designs, and that most plans don't have a brokerage window, but a certain significant number do, particularly a lot of larger plans. And I think DOL's wanting to understand just whether there are issues there that they should be concerned about or thinking about guidance on, where it's a sort of quote-unquote normal plan feature as opposed to an exotic plan design.
Yeah, and I actually think there could be some more aggressive guidance where every participant is put into a brokerage account, which I think would be more common of a small professional organization, a medical group, a law firm, something like that. I'm just saying there's a chance. But anyway, well, you know, Brad, unless you have something to add, I think that completes our walkthrough of the semiannual regulatory agenda from the DOL. I know that you are going to move on to discussions of cases now, and I think you lead that off.
Well, the last thing I would just point out about the agenda, they haven't, as you all probably know, the new 408B2 guide disclosure is a current proposal that was put out a couple of months ago. The comment period closes next week, actually, on the 10th, I believe. So there's a lot of ongoing comment on that. I thought it was interesting that a new agenda didn't propose a next step date. It indicated that it was open for comment, but it didn't suggest when the next step, moving to a final reg, would occur. So it suggests that DOL is going to be intending to spend some time reviewing the comments they've received on this guide summary, which I think is good, because I think as a lot of us looking at it have thought, there are a lot of ambiguities and questions and concerns, some real practical issues with how the 408B2 guide would be triggered or implemented or required that DOL is going to need to sort through.
Okay, on to you. On to the cases.
Okay, on to the cases. Well, let me start out by, and then I'll turn this over to Ted Becker, who's the head of our ERISA litigation group at Drinker Biddle. I want to talk a little bit about ESOPs, and this is one of the developments that just popped up. You know, one of the difficulties the ESOP community has had over the years is the fact that DOL has issued almost no guidance on some of the core issues that go to dealing with ESOPs, evaluation of securities, what are the fiduciary obligations, and what's the fiduciary process that the department expects to see on some of these questions of assigning valuations and doing the transactions. And so we've just recently, on behalf of some of our clients, reached a settlement with the department, which is, in effect, the first time the department has put out what it's had in its sort of inner thoughts about what prudence really means in these situations. We now finally have a guide in the form of a settlement. So I want to introduce Ted Becker to explain that and talk a little bit about what's a pretty significant development in the ESOP community.
Thanks, Brad. Hello, everybody. Speaking of gray areas, this was a very gray area, and now it's getting black and white. As we all know, this is the 40th anniversary of the enactment of ERISA. In 1988, there was a proposed regulation relating to the definition of adequate consideration 26 years ago. In 1996, because the regulation never became final, the courts began referring to the proposed regulation in cases that related to the definition of adequate consideration. Just in terms of the statutory context, ERISA 408E2 provides an exemption from prohibited transaction rules and permits the sale of employer stock by a party in interest if the purchase is made for adequate consideration. So the proposed regulation defined adequate consideration as the fair market value of the asset determined in good faith by the fiduciary, and good faith and fair market value both focus on the conduct of the fiduciary. In other words, everybody understands, or at least should understand, that it's impossible to guess what a company is going to be doing going forward. So the courts have, as one court said, looked to the process, because what's required of a fiduciary in approving an ESOP transaction for a particular stock price is prudence and not prescience. But the process has always been the gray area. So how did we get to today? Well, fiduciary conduct is enforced by the DOL, and ESOPs are a national project of the Employee Benefits Security Administration. In fact, the EPSA enforcement manual says that one of the most common violations found, in its view, is the incorrect valuation of employer securities. So financial experts were retained by the DOL post the great crash, the Great Recession in 2009 and 10, And then certain regional offices became very aggressive, as did the National Solicitor's Office. But there was an inconsistent enforcement of what people considered to be a prudent process. Multiple lawsuits were filed across the country by the Department of Labor against ESOP trustees, and all in some way challenged the valuation of the stock, the price, and the process. So one of those cases, Sierra Aluminum Company case in Central California, is a case in which we represented a client. There are also numerous investigations across the country of pre-recession ESOP transactions. In short, the relationship between the DOL and the ESOP community became very tenuous. Our client and also committees of ESOP Association that we are working with decided to try to find a common ground with the Department of Labor rather than wage war against it constantly, and to try to develop a playbook that both the DOL and the great and our client agreed upon. And the playbook can be used for all future transactions. Following the playbook provides safeguards because the DOL has agreed to it as well. So in effect, we feel that we have the guidance that we never had before as to what constitutes a prudent process. The negotiations to get to this point were over 18 months of constructive and collaborative discussions with top DOL officials in Washington, D.C., both in the Solicitor's Office and EPSA. And the framework of the discussions were the policies and procedures that, frankly, our client and others have had in place for many years. What we wanted to do was we wanted to put them down in black and white. And so we shared ideas. The parties mutually agreed on a process for fiduciary conduct in transactions that involve non-publicly traded stock. And as a result, we feel we've established a positive channel of communication on this issue with top decision makers at the DOL, and we've documented with the DOL in an agreed document that establishes expectations for fiduciary conduct. Phyllis Borzi earlier this week said, quote, "Others in the industry would do well to take notice of the protections put in place by this agreement." So we're going to be having a specific webinar for those that are interested, walking through this new process and giving details with regard to how it came to be and how we feel that it can be implemented.
Yeah, so just to sort of sum that up in an even more pithy way, for a long time folks have been having to guess what DOL enforcers who bring investigations and litigation would think is the right process, and if you guessed wrong, well, you ended up in a long, protracted difficulty with the Department of Labor where you were saying, my process is adequate, and they said, well, it's not the process we thought it ought to be, even though we never told you what that process was. So this is a pretty significant development in terms of having a process DOL itself is now trying to point to as sort of the guidebook or playbook for how to proceed. So, you know, as Ted said, we're going to do a separate webinar on this to drill down into it for those of you who are in the ESOP, area. And for those of you who aren't, feel free to alert some of your colleagues who are, because this really is a significant development in terms of eliminating a lot of the uncertainty and risk that's been going into some of these transactions.
Well, and Brad, you were involved in those negotiations also, weren't you?
Yes, Ted and I and several others have spent quite a bit of time working on that. We're certainly pleased with how it turned out.
That's great. Very good. Congratulations to both you guys. We're still in the litigation mode, and as the announcement for this program said, I'm going to talk about the ING case now. But to give you some context, I'll back away just a little bit. And as I see it, there are two main types of litigation going on against record keepers or providers right now. One is that they're fiduciaries because they set their own fees, and I think that occurs especially in group annuity contracts. For example, a group annuity contract might say that we, the provider, can set our fees between 0 and 100 basis points. And the movement, if any, would occur because the revenue sharing wasn't enough to cover the cost of operating the plan. That's sort of how the system works. So that ability to change the fees, the discretion to change the fees, even if the fees are never changed. So that's one type of cause of action against providers. The second one is the ability to remove investments and replace them with other investments, which, if you think about it, means the ability to control the amount of revenue sharing that the record keeper receives. Because if you take out a low revenue sharing fund and put in a high revenue sharing fund, in theory, a record keeper or a provider could increase their compensation. Those theories have been out there, both of them, for a number of years now, and there are a number of decided cases on them. Just a few years ago in the Seventh Circuit, which is centered in Chicago and it's in the Great Lakes area, held in the case of Limekiller versus AUL that having that discretion did not cause AUL as a provider to be a fiduciary because they hadn't exercised it. Or perhaps in one or two cases they exercised it, but they were only a fiduciary to the extent that they exercised it. Now, to back away from that, the legal theory that the court was looking at is one of the three definitions of a fiduciary under ERISA. There are three definitions. That's all there are under ERISA. 321A1 says if you manage plan assets, if you have the discretion or if you exercise control over plan assets. But you have to exercise the discretion or just exercise control, even if you're not given discretion, over the management, keyword, management. We're going to call that the management fiduciary. The second one I'll just mention, that's the fiduciary advice definition. We're going to take that one off the table because it's not in play in these cases. The third one is the so-called administrative definition. If someone has discretionary authority or control over the administration of a plan, and a lot of you, that in lawyer language is 321A3, ERISA section 321A3, but a lot of y'all will think of that as a 316 administrative fiduciary. In other words, 316 says, here's how you identify the administrative fiduciary. 321A3 says, here's what the duties of an administrative fiduciary could be, and that there could be an effective functional administrative fiduciary, even if somebody's not designated to be one. So you have those 321A1 management fiduciary, 321A3 administrative fiduciary. Well, in that case of Limekiller versus AUL, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals looked at the AUL situation and said, well, gee, to the extent you never exercised your discretion under the contract to change investments or fees or whatever, you're not a fiduciary because you're only a fiduciary under the management definition if you actually exercise discretion or control. And that, everybody in the legal community that represents service providers heaved a sigh of relief when that decision came out a few years ago. More recently, there's a case of Healthcare Strategies versus ING. But just a sidelight on that case, many of you all have heard of the Aetna amendment provision. That's where if you have a provision in your contract as a provider, and you all should, every provider on this call should have an amendment provision for their fees, their services, and investments, and so on, regardless of whether you're a compliance-only provider or if you do something associated with the investments. But in 1997, the DOL issued to Aetna an advisory opinion that says if you have a provision that says that you can have negative consents and you give adequate notice you're going to make a change to the investment lineup, and I believe it applies to any change to the agreement. And then if somebody disagrees, you give them an adequate period of time, they say in that case it was 60 days, to find a new provider, then any amendment that comes into effect because of that, any investment change that results because of that, will be deemed to be the plan sponsor fiduciary's decision and not the provider's decision. In other words, it's a great way for providers to shift fiduciary responsibility onto the plan sponsors, yet be able to refresh their package that they offer to the public and keep good investments in it and get rid of investments that fall off in quality. Well, for those of you who are inside the industry, you know that Aetna later became ING. Aetna and ING are, in essence, one and the same, although ING had other acquisitions that made up their retirement services group. In any event, they didn't have an Aetna provision, and they did make some investment changes. And To the extent they made a couple of investment changes, it seems pretty clear. Certainly the court found that they were a fiduciary for that purpose. More interestingly, the court found that Aetna was also a fiduciary because it had discretion to remove investments. And there the court said, you know, we saw that Limekeuler decision that said under the management definition of fiduciary, you have to exercise the discretion in order to be a fiduciary. We're not disagreeing with Limekeuler. We're finding ING to be a fiduciary under the administrative definition of fiduciary. In other words, the court found that the definition of administrative, which is not defined in ERISA, by the way, was so broad that it could include picking and removing and replacing investments. So for all of you out there thinking about being a 316 fiduciary, you now have at least one court decision that says your responsibilities may be much greater than you think. In other words, the definition of administrative has been thrown into play. ING settled the case ultimately for $16 million, just as a bit of a sad footnote for the participants at least. The attorneys got $6 million out of the $16 million. Also, in the settlement agreement, there were a number of changes in business practices about ING could no longer remove and replace funds that were actually in plans under any circumstance. If they were going to remove a investment that was in their product menu, that is all the funds they offered but one that wasn't actually in a particular plan, they had to post advance notice on their website and on and on. Anyway, there were a series of other conditions as well as a monetary settlement. So that's where the law stood at the time we sent out our notice. Since then, though, there's the Golden Star versus Mass Mutual decision. In that decision, the court looked at both the situations I mentioned initially. One is you can set your fees between 0 and 1%, your annual fee. And the court found that if it went to trial, it was possible that MassMutual could be found to be a fiduciary for that purpose. You know, kind of interesting. They didn't really say they found anything in the record that led them to conclude that. Instead, the court said the overall discussion of fees on the record, meaning most likely the arguments presented by the attorneys on both sides of the case, the overall discussion of fees in the record is impenetrable. I think that word impenetrable means the judge threw up his hands and said, this thing is so complicated, and there's so many different versions of what's happening here, I can't figure it out. So at least at this point, I'm going to let it go to trial. But that it's funny how he reached this conclusion, not by pointing to specific facts, but pointing to some disagreement over the facts and then just saying, hey, I can't figure all this out. It's impenetrable. And so that you know, in this kind of a motion, since MassMutual filed the motion to throw out the case, all the facts have to be interpreted to any reasonable extent in favor of the plaintiff. So it wasn't a balancing of the facts that led to that conclusion. It was looking at all the facts and saying, look, I got to read this in favor of the plaintiff. Going on to the second issue, the second claim was that MassMutual was a fiduciary by virtue of removing and replacing investments in the plans. The court there agreed with the Limekeuler Seventh Circuit decision. It says, well, wait a second, you're not a fiduciary under the management, the 321A1 definition, because that only applies if you exercise discretion. So to the extent you didn't exercise discretion to actually remove and replace a fund, you're not a fiduciary. The court then moved on to the ING court's decision about that a administrative fiduciary could be responsible for removing and replacing investments. And the court said, even if discretion to substitute investments on the plan menu falls within the broad definition of administration of a plan, I think the fact that the court said even if expresses some skepticism on that topic. And frankly, I have skepticism. My view of administration is much more aligned with the MassMutual argument, which was calculating vesting, determining eligibility, you know, calculating benefits to be paid out, and so on. that I view management as being the investments. But in any event, we've got courts all over the place. So the court said, even if the discretion to substitute investments on the plan menu falls within a broad definition of administration, plaintiff's argument fails under the to the extent requirement. In other words, MassMutual did not exercise its discretion to put in other funds that paid it more revenue sharing. So this court questions the argument or the position of the ING healthcare strategies decision that an administrative fiduciary could be responsible for investments, but then goes on to find that since MassMutual didn't exercise that discretion, they aren't a fiduciary for that purpose. Okay, Brad, I sort of raced through that, but I just wanted people to get the flavor of it. Maybe you could give us the 50,000-foot view of the GAO report on tax incentives and the proposals on tax reform.
Sure. So one of the ongoing issues we've been a little bit worried about now for some time is that the effect comprehensive tax reform or tax reforms necessary to meet short-term issues like debt ceiling or government shutting down due to lack of authorization to spend money, worrying about what the effects of some of those deals might have on the tax treatment of retirement plans and how they could affect the incentives for plans to be formed and operated. The GAO poured some fuel on the fire by issuing a report that looked at who's benefiting from the current tax treatment of that plan. And they cut the data a lot of different ways. And one of the issues that seemed to catch a lot of media attention from that report is that the most likely people contributing at the higher end of the $17,500 limit tended to be, wealthier white males. So, that wasn't necessarily helpful to the debate on this. I think part of the issue is continuing, though, if you look at the data, continuing to see that, in fact, most people participating in the 401k plans are certainly not high-income folks. They're people who make less than $100,000 a year who are, using this for the real purpose, which is to save for their retirements, and the tax incentives are actually very important to that. What is this going to mean in the short term? Probably not much, because we're probably not looking to see any, certainly not seeing any comprehensive tax reform coming through Congress before, in this Congress. Probably not seeing any short-term fights either, just given, where we are in the budget process. So probably what we're really worrying about this and other issues coming up is over the next 2 or 3 years, when both sides of Congress really do seem interested in doing comprehensive tax reform because it fuels a lot of their other objectives. But again, our overall wariness needs to be a lot of the decisions that will be made will be driven by revenue needs to feed the government spending rather than by retirement policy needs, and we really need to make sure those policy interests are well represented as the debate starts.
Great. And then talking about policy, what about the IRS revenue ruling 2014-9 and the rollover process?
Yeah, so this is partly in response to some of the GAO criticism in its looking at rollover issues, where the GAO said, because there's a private sector profit interest, doing a private rollover from a plan to an IRA is a relatively simple process. There's interest in making it streamlined and move straight forward, but that the same is not true of plan-to-plan rollovers, that there are a lot of institutional barriers and hurdles and legal issues and so forth, not the least of which, of course, is that a plan's not required to accept a rollover from another plan. So in the revenue ruling the IRS put out recently, they tried to address some of that by providing some examples of how a plan could verify that an incoming plan rollover was in fact legit and coming from a plan and was qualified, et cetera. Things like looking at the 5500 and seeing if this plan that the rollover is coming from has identified itself as a qualified plan, et cetera. I personally don't think it achieved a whole lot. I don't think it's harmful. It might be mildly helpful, but in the grand scheme of things, I don't know that this revenue ruling is actually a huge deal.
Now, I think this is a part of a larger thing that's going on. If you look at the GAO report and you look at what FINRA's done about rollovers, the fact that the SEC has placed rollovers on its 2014 examination priorities, we talked about how the DOL could include rollovers in the reproposed fiduciary regulation. I actually think as the boomers are retiring now, they're going from being bubble wrapped inside 401k plans with low fees and services and target date funds and just a managed environment by the plan fiduciaries, And then they're getting to age 65 or 70 and saying, okay, get out of this plan. You have very little experience at investing other than picking well-selected investments that we gave you that are low price. Now go out into the retail world and make your way. And I think the DOL is sort of looking at that, and these government agencies are looking at that, and they're saying, wait a second. That doesn't make a lot of sense that we get people to 65 or 70, you know, where they're really protected in a fiduciary environment, and then we say, you know, you go out into a retail environment where your fees are going to be much higher and where there are a lot more conflicts of interest. And I think that the view is developing within these regulatory agencies that it's a good idea to try to keep money inside retirement plans. I think this rollover guidance also is part of that, that they would rather have the money go from one plan to another plan. They see that as more desirable than having it go from a plan into a retail environment. So I think we could see a lot more over the next several years encouraging plan sponsors to keep money in plans rather than plan sponsors encouraging participants to get money out of plans. I recently did a poll of a handful of people, and it seems like there is a definite increase in large plans and mid-sized plans in retaining money of retired participants. I'm not saying it's a tidal wave by any means, but some increase over just, say, 5 years ago. Brad, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the government is looking to try and make it easier to keep money in plans. We've already talked about some of the issues. For example, I think if the government were to take the view that because you're a fiduciary to a plan, you're not able to do a rollover, is counterproductive. I think it's just illogical on its face to say that because you were a vetted, trusted fiduciary advisor who went through the process of, the bubble wrap world of ERISA. Therefore, when a participant comes to you and says, hey, I want to do a rollover with you because I know you and trust you, the answer should be no, go talk to a stranger. I mean, I think there's some middle ground that DOL is going to have to figure out if they're really going to crack down on rollover solicitations. That's one thing. But I do agree with you. I think the government is interested in seeing money remain in plans longer. What I think is going to be interesting to see is if there really is a market appetite for that. In other words, how many plan sponsors who historically have really kind of wanted their participants to leave to reduce the administrative complexities of the plan, how many of them are going to say, but maybe we'd really rather have some of you stay because it's a lot of assets involved, and overall this might be better for us to keep some of these assets here in the plan and work through the administrative issues.
I'm already seeing some of that start to change. I agree. I think rollovers were woven into the fabric. I just think the common assumption is people retire and they take their money out and roll an IRA, and that's actually woven into the fabric of the industry. It's woven into the fabric of common thinking. But I think the government's going to challenge that. And it's a little bit more difficult for small plans because a small plan can be terminated when the entrepreneur dies or retires. So maybe there'd be less confidence in leaving money there. But you get to companies that are, that seem to be perpetual, at least measured by some individual's lifetime, then there could be a higher degree of confidence leaving it there and continuing to get the fiduciary protection. So I think it will gain some traction, maybe not huge traction, but some traction. We wanted to say one thing about DOL investigations of fiduciary service providers, Brad, and then we'll open it up for questions.
Yeah, we've continued to see over the last several years, and it's definitely continuing this year, a much higher level of incidents of investigations of service providers. This is consistent with DOL's national enforcement priorities regarding fiduciary service providers and major case priority. It just continues to be something we're seeing an awful lot of, investigations of service providers as service providers. And these are very wide-ranging investigations. They can include the service provider's own plans to its own employees, as well as all of the services it does for ERISA plans, all of the disclosures it makes, all of the ways it's getting compensated, contracts related to third parties who help the service provider provide the services. I mean, these are just very broad investigations that service providers are going through.
Yeah, we're representing right now RIAs, broker-dealers, record keepers and compliance-only TPAs on DOL investigations. So it's happening. It's happening out there. Interestingly, we're also seeing some SEC examinations of service providers where they're bringing up ERISA issues or fiduciary issues inside IRAs, the privity transaction issues in IRAs. So the SEC seems to be joining in the fray. And, you know, for all those people who have been saying for years that the SEC and the DOL should coordinate more, I think we're actually seeing that happening now on a number of levels. But to see SEC examinations where they have a whole laundry list of relatively sophisticated, if not exactly right, but relatively sophisticated ERISA issues raised, has been something that while it was there for a long time, it's relatively recent at the volume we're seeing. Well, let's go ahead and open it up to questions. Angela, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And we'll pause for just a moment. And we will take our first question.
Hi, guys. Thanks for all the great information today. This is Skip Schweiss. I'm wondering if you are still seeing in the field DOL asking plan sponsor fiduciaries whether they've had fiduciary training. So committees, whether they've had fiduciary training. I know we've heard about that in the last year, so I'm wondering if you're seeing a continuation or increase or decrease.
I had a case just a few months ago, Skip. It might have been at the end of last year rather than this year, but pretty recent, yeah. Brad?
Yeah, we continue to see that question. It's not on every one. You know, we don't see it as a 100% standard question on the list that we get, but it's not uncommon. You know, again, the thing to remember is while they're asking about it, and that implies that they think it ought to be there, there is no legal requirement that the training be there. So while we certainly think it's a good idea to provide fiduciary training, and it's never a harmful thing to be able to tell DOL that you do it, there isn't an actual requirement that it be part of that process.
You know, we've taken, Skip, just as an aside, we've taken to where we educate our plan, do the fiduciary training. Usually we try to do it once a year for our plan committees. That, you know, the first one is like fiduciary basics, and the one each year is like more like a little bit of a refresher with current issues. And then we give them like a little certificate. We've created like a college diploma-looking type certificate where the committee members can then put it in their files, and if the DOL ever investigates, they can just provide a copy of that to them. So, you know, at least on my account, we're taking it fairly seriously.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star 1 at this time. And we'll take our next question.
Hi. This is Todd Hockman from Raymond James. You mentioned that you're seeing DOL investigations of service providers where the DOL is asking about the provider's own plans. Are you referring to providers who have proprietary mutual funds in their plans or just in general?
We've kind of seen it both ways. It really depends. Not every investigation of a service provider has gone to their own plan. Sometimes they're just there to look at them as a service provider. It just sort of seems to vary a bit by region and by interest. But we've seen both of those occur, where they're looking at justifying the inclusion of proprietary products or alternatively just a general review of the provider as a plan sponsor rather than just as a provider.
Yeah, some of the things that got looked at are definitely proprietary investments. There's some class action litigation by private attorneys on that, or class action type litigation, representing all the plan participants nominally. The interesting thing to me is there is an exemption if you use your own investments in a plan, so long as they're prudent choices. But I think the real exposure to the broker-dealer or the RIA or the record keeper, the provider, one of the conditions of the exemption that nobody's really focused on until recently is that it has to be no more expensive, if you will, it has to be on the same terms, on arm's length terms is what I'm trying to get to. Well, you know, 10 years ago, arm's length just meant, you know, if you had a retail share, you used a retail share. Today, that seems to mean that, you know, if you're a big enough plan to have the right to have institutional share classes or other low-cost share classes, that you're not using a retail share. And I'm worried that a lot of plan committees at financial institutions have not gone back and reevaluated the share classes that they're using in light of the more recent litigation, like the Walmart case, the Southern California Edison case, and some others. If I were going to look at one thing as a provider that had affiliated mutual funds in my plan, I would make sure the committee was aware of the privative transaction exemption, and I would make sure that in particular they paid attention to that condition, that it be arm's length, meaning what a third, the same as what a third party would do. And a third party with, $250 million in plan assets might not buy retail shares. So that to me is the number one issue there. The other issues are like, is any money being paid to the company for help in administering the plan? We see that one come up sometimes. Any other favorable treatment, any payments from investment managers or anything like that? For example, if you have the ABC mutual fund in there and the broker-dealer gets revenue sharing on ABC funds, they've got to turn it off for the amount that's in the plan. Just a whole host of little issues like that, but they're basically dollar amount conflict of interest issues. You really have to be careful. Is that it? Operator?
There appears to be no further questions at this time.
Well, let me make one last comment, and then I think later this year, 408B2 examinations are going to start of plan sponsors, investigations by the DOL, and I think some of those can segue over to the service providers who either did not provide a 408B2 disclosure or who provided an inadequate disclosure. So that's sort of on my radar screen for future DOL investigations of service providers. Having said that, Jim, do you want to bid us a fond adieu?
Gladly. Fred, Brad, Ted, thanks for making the call. And again, thank you to everyone who joined us today. We at Natixis appreciate the partnership and look forward to doing the call. So next quarter, so mark your calendar, September 18th. And Fred, I'm pretty sure that you folks will be sending out an email to let people know of the recording and the next call. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Perfect. Excellent. Angela, thanks so much for facilitating the call, and we look forward to September 18th. Thanks so much.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you all very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.